A warning, this podcast uses the sound of gunshots, live reports, firsthand accounts, and other sounds related to active shootings. If you need crisis counseling related to shootings, the National Disaster Distress Hotline is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can call 1-800-985-5990 or text 66746. If you know someone who may be a danger to the community or may be considering an act of violence yourself, please seek help. You can call your local authorities immediately. Many times you can be anonymous. Sandy Hook Promise also has a tip system called Say Something Tips. Just go to sandyhookpromise.org. Normal Tuesday at the office, the beginning of the year brings with it the mandatory annual life safety training, a video put together by Human Resources that includes where to go in case of a fire, a tornado, and yes, an active shooter.
Call 911 if it's safe to do so. Call lobby security and main number if it's safe to do so. Listen for commotion, arguing, loud noises. Move away from that. Silence your cell phone. Even the vibration from your cell phone can give away your hiding place.
This video also includes instruction from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security.
If your path is clear and you can safely reach an exit, evacuate as soon as possible. Of course, some may not have such easy access to a safe exit. In these situations, you must decide for yourself whether it is best to evacuate or to hide. If you are confronted by the active shooter, you have to assume that your actions are all that stand between yourself, your colleagues, and grave harm. Fight for your life.
We've been doing this kind of office training for years. Sometimes it's a video, sometimes it's a fire or police official speaking to the group. It always includes active shooter training. I'm sure many people listening to this, whether office workers, factory workers, hospital workers, teachers, bankers, gas station attendants, hotel staff, numerous other industries use the same video, the same directions, the same information.
If you spray somebody in the face with the fire extinguisher, you're going to get, you know, some seconds or a minute to get away. Sometimes that's all you need. Your heels, your keys, you know, in your fist, you could, you know, punch somebody or hit somebody with. Full soda can in your socks. You'd be surprised if you take your socks off and put a couple cans of soda. That's a lethal weapon.
Now here's some video posted online by the Freeze Foundation, which offers security consulting to churches and synagogues and more in-depth training than my company's web video, like belts that block doors.
No matter how hard you pull on this, this thing's not going. Yeah, your arm is in this. I get it. However, you've just essentially locked this door.
Threat! Go, go, go!
We've discussed Alice and Alert training in previous episodes. This is common in the U.S., right? How about the rest of the world? Do other countries spend as much time, energy, and money on security and training to prevent active shootings like we do?
My name is Bram van der Meer. Greetings from the Netherlands. I'm a clinical and investigative psychologist, as we call it here. I'm specialized in the psychology of investigations, and more specifically, I'm interested and specialized in risk assessment, assessing risk and threats. So that gets me into all kinds of work related to violence. My background is within the police. I was part of a profiling unit here in the Netherlands for many years. But now I have my own company, my own advisory company, and I support all kinds of organizations, public sector, private sector, when they're dealing with difficult or criminal or violent or disordered behavior. Mm-hmm. Behaviors that they're concerned about and that raises the question like, where is this leading to? This guy making these comments or taking this to his office or behaving this particular way or saying these things, what does it mean? How should we interpret that? Is that potential violence coming our way, or what's going to happen? So that's where I offer some advice and guidance. And when there is any risk, I'll try to mitigate and try to help them manage the risk in order not to escalate further.
Can you tell me about maybe some of the cases you've worked on?
Two cases come to mind. One is one I'm working right at the moment, so I thought that might be interesting for you to hear and for the listeners to this program. So here's, you have this young doctor still in his training at the university as an academic hospital where he's working. And at some point, and this is about 4 years ago, he starts complaining about the professor not using the right books, not be as clever as he expected them to be. He complains about how the university deals with the exams and with tests and all that. And he's complaining at different departments about these things. This guy's getting very annoying, and some people get afraid because he's calling them or sending letters and sending long texts for every day or at least every week. But these departments, they never communicate with each other. So HR doesn't communicate with the dean. The dean doesn't communicate with the doctors. So all this information, all these things that this guy is doing is not centralized to one specific point where somebody is sitting down and say, hey, what do we have here? And this is what we call, it's important in our field, this is what we call the silo effect. So information is spread around. We need to get that information together in order to understand the risks better. So, and people don't report, you know, people tend not to report this behavior. They're concerned, they're worried. They think, well, if I'm reporting this, this guy might be very aggressive and he could come to my house. Or so I'd rather say nothing. That's what we call in criminology the dark number. It's those crimes that exist, but we don't see because it's not reported. And I can only refer to Dutch statistics in the Netherlands. About 20% of the violence that occurs in society is known to the authorities. So the other 80%, we just don't know, right? And that's the underreporting that we have. And then another case that I can think of, Ryan, is of an employee who develops these thoughts of, he's getting very suspicious about what his colleagues are doing with him. He thinks that they might poison him. He gets very paranoid. It makes him angry and upset because he feels that colleagues are gossiping about this guy. He's an isolated person. He doesn't have a relationship. His anger is increasing. Finally, he quits his job. He starts using drugs. He quits his job because he feels too afraid and too harassed in his current work. And all of this is not true. It's his own belief, his own belief system. And once he leaves the office, he starts to harass his colleagues who have been, in his view, harassing and bullying him. And this continues and continues. And these people getting afraid because he's following them home. He's waiting for them at the train station and follows them home. We see that there's more and more drug use and social isolation. So what I've done, just explained to you, is a couple of risk factors that we know from research and science that are indicative of future violence. Social isolation, drug use, paranoid ideation, him by himself in social isolation. And this creates a situation where I could say in this case, I'm concerned about his future. I'm concerned about future escalation because of what we know about this case. And
So let me ask you, in that situation then, are you intervening? Are you providing tools to the people who come to you to intervene? And the other aspect too is, you know, if someone's got domestic violence, someone's got problems at home, that's not the works issue. That's not the workplace issue. Or if someone's got workplace issues, they get angry, and then they take it home. I mean, people live in different worlds too. So I don't know how intervening goes in those situations.
So my role here is that the organization consults me and asks me, okay, how do you assess this situation? Is this potentially dangerous? Is this going to escalate? And I can provide an answer to that. I need information, of course. And what I do is I have access to the police. I can, my former colleagues, I can contact them about his history. I have people in the organization, his former colleagues, that I can talk to about his behavior, about what the stories that he told, when did it start, how was he in a group setting, et cetera, et cetera. I can raise all these questions. So what I do is I check all these risk factors and I use this information sources to make a final risk assessment. Of course, there's always missing information. There's never going to be like a psychological report or a full criminal history. So it's bits and pieces, but we're trying to stick those things together. And you're mentioning like two different worlds, your workspace and a private space. Of course, I'm not going to know everything about his private life, but often I can also speak to the person, right? I can also ask questions. And some people are not, they're willing to speak, especially people who are stalkers and who threaten. They're very willing to speak because they're frustrated, they're angry, and they think they're right. So that's why I often speak to these people and say, well, you know, Johnny, I'm concerned about your behavior. Why do you harass these people? And he tells my host the whole story. He feels he's right. Yeah. And he's in his right to do this.
Is your focus in risk assessment on a human individual, or is it also in a certain space or a certain event that is taking place?
Yeah, both. Sometimes it's just, let's say,
a school, a church, a large gathering. They might call you in and say, hey, what is the potential here?
Who's
going to be coming in and out of this place? Should we be concerned? A synagogue would be a terrific example, right?
Yeah, exactly. And my previous job at the National Police, where I worked for many years, I was responsible for the protection of the royal family. So when they had events, the birthday of the Queen, or the Queen going somewhere to for some ceremony, you always have to look at what is the ceremony all about and who doesn't like this and who has a grudge against the Queen and the royal family and them having so much money, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where you try to gather all this information from different sources.
And would that include terror organizations as well then?
Yeah, that's...
Or is that a little outside of your
that's
realm?
That's a little bit of outside of... That's a specific field, the terrorism threat assessment. It's part of the threat assessment world, but it's not really my expertise.
Sure.
I must say that, and I can tell you this regarding terrorists, is that it's often thought that terrorists have this strong political beliefs and their ideology or their religion. But often we know that these people, what motivates them is their mental health and their life issues. As a well-known professor in my field, Dr. Reid Malloy, would say, terrorists are not happy people. They have concerns. They're frustrated. They're angry. And for the terrorists that I've interviewed after the offense, I must say I realized how very little they knew about the political system or the ideology or the religion that they so much support.
One of the things that you know we've been kind of diving into with this podcast is about the preparations we have in America for mass casualty events, mass shootings events, you know, mass shooting drills at schools. Yeah. Does that kind of preparation, public preparation, happen in Europe or elsewhere, or are we pretty unique in that?
I think I can't speak for other parts of the world. The world is much bigger than Europe. But I can say about Europe that we are very different from you guys. There's quite some resistance to do these drills and to be busy with preparation of mass casualties. I see in America, of course, if you look at the statistics, I understand that people want to be prepared for something like that to happen. But in Europe, we have less, much less school shootings, much less mass casualties. We do have, but we advertise, the media is not that strong on it here. And it's also not our culture to focus on this. A school preparing for violence, let's say these drills, that will be in a newspaper. And people say, what is this kind of nonsense? What are you doing? You're making our children scared about nothing.
If a situation like that were to happen,
we have had situations like that.
But you don't have parents demanding security increases, security upgrades, these kind of drills, security outside, metal detectors. Reaction.
No. Definitely not. That's not how it works here. That's not how. A good example is that our prime minister, our former prime minister, insisted that he would be able to drive his bicycle from his home to his office in the morning. And he could stop at the grocery store and the bakery to get himself a sandwich. We are very much sort of anti-protection security measures. We want to be free. I want to make our own decisions. And I think that's part of our history, too. Maybe I can tell you this, too, related to these cultural differences. What I see, luckily enough to be going to the United States and meet my colleagues and friends there. And what I see there is a strong focus on the offender being a predator, being a criminal and a mass murderer. We don't have those. That's different in our country. Way more focused, we're more offender focused. So a typical response after a shooting, we had a shooting in a hospital, a former student, medical student who was angry, shot his professor right in front of the classroom and shot his two other people too. Serious, serious incident. The response of, in general, of the public is, what have we missed? What have we done wrong for this poor individual to be committing such a horrendous offense? He must have given signs, and why didn't we pick it up? Why? So we're also, if you look at our forensic psychology work here in Holland and in Europe, we are very much specialized in treatment of offenders, risk assessment of offenders. And we have, unfortunately, that's the backside, is we have way less attention for the victim. I think there's this in America, and that makes it strong and good. I miss that often here, is the focus on the victim, protection of the victim, mental health, feeling safe. That's sort of a new movement in our society.
When you discuss that student who's angry, has been lashing out, has been speaking out about things, and you're able to kind of connect the dots, do you know what avenue that person is going down? Is it harming others or self-harm? Are you checking to see if they're trained in weapons? How does the process go with that?
I'm a psychologist, so I'm looking at behavior, and I'm looking for behavioral risk factors. Of course, I also check, does this person have a military background? Which groups is he member of? Does he have a focus or fascination for weapons? But the whole weapon topic is much less of an issue here. We have less guns. I know from my American friends that the people who do the same job as I do here in Europe, they tell me sometimes they're concerned about the American situation is focusing so much on the gun violence. Does he have a gun history? Does he know how to handle a weapon, et cetera, and sort of forgetting about the psychological harm, the stalking, the harassment, the false allegations, et cetera, et cetera.
Maybe they don't have a gun. Are there concerns about other forms of mass casualties, whether it be stabbings, whether it be bombings in some cases, whether it be vehicle rammings?
We do have mass casualties here, and most of the situation, if I just, I don't have statistics right here in front of me, but vehicles, using a vehicle is a method that these incidents happen on a regular basis. For instance, a Christmas market in Germany, we recently had where somebody drove into the public, and we had 2-3 cases in 1 year. We had a situation in the Netherlands too, a couple of years ago on the Queen's birthday, where a guy took his car and ran over people just right into the crowd. I can't recall a shooting where somebody shot multiple persons, except for that hospital incident that I told you about. And one concern that we have here is that because of the war not too far away from us in Ukraine, and the war between Russia and Ukraine, we have Ukrainian people coming into our country. We have movements. So we expect that there will be more guns available in a couple of years. That's a concern because availability, of course, increases the risk of using it. For instance, if you look at domestic violence, most of the domestic violence killings and domestic violence incidents in the United States are committed with a firearm. Over here, it's quite the contrary. Our offenders use knives and physical harm, right? Using your hands, strangulation, and knives. Using knives is most common in our country in Europe. So, and we know from research that availability of firearms increases significantly the risk for lethality. So, and it's also, if you think about it, if I have a gun and I'm angry with my wife, for instance, if the gun is available, I don't have to get closer, just pull the trigger and that's it, right? Mm-hmm. While I have a knife, a weapon of opportunity, I go to the kitchen, I have a knife in my hand, I still need to get close to her. I need to take that knife and stab it into her. That's a different ballgame.
Yeah.
It's a different situation. So there's way more resistance and there's way more things that keep me not doing it compared to guns.
The domestic violence is still there in Europe. It is existent.
It's a serious problem.
So it's kind of an interesting conclusion then from speaking with a colleague in South Korea. And he said that when people are having these psychological issues, they tend to internalize it more. They turn it more on themselves. Huge suicide rate in South Korea, double what we have in the United States and Europe. It sounds like in Europe, that kind of emotional trauma goes to people close by, right? Family members, abuse in that kind of way. Yeah. And perhaps in the United States, maybe because of guns, it gets widened even further to someone wanting to take aggression out on other people. I'm just hypothesizing at this point.
Interesting points that you're making there. No, I think there's some truth to it. Yeah, and I mean, domestic violence kills way more people than any terrorist attacks. I found some numbers yesterday, actually. Let me read it for you. In United States, domestic violence, 4,000 killings per year. Public mass shootings, about 500, approximately, per year. In Europe, domestic violence kills about 1,500 people in the European Union every year. Public mass shootings, not even 100. So that just shows you.
Sure.
And for me, often I think, look, why are we so much focused on these terrorist attacks and mass casualties while the biggest problem is happening behind the front door? And we are so reluctant, and we're so careful in not intervening in that private space. Most people get killed there, in their own house, right? So that's an interesting. I mean, the answer is that terrorist attacks and mass shootings are unpredictable. They involve strangers. They receive intense media coverage, and they occur in public spaces. While domestic violence, they happen in private settings, in your own home. It's repetitive and ongoing. It doesn't stop. It just goes on day by day. It's rarely covered by national breaking news if a woman or a guy got killed by his partner. And they're often treated as isolated incidents. While the truth is that domestic violence is serial. It happens, it continues and continues over years or months and before it escalates. So that, and we invest all our money and time as governments and organizations on the mass casualties, which is good, of course. I don't want to say do less research or don't do something about the guns or whatever. But I'm saying don't forget about domestic violence, where way more people are killed. You mentioned the media coverage also. What concerns me about this is that many of these offenders who commit these school shootings and mass casualties, they do it for their own notoriety. They do it because they want to be heard and seen. They're angry and upset. They're frustrated about society. They're angry with their own lives. And they want to make a statement and they want to be seen. And they see, potential offenders, of course, see how much media coverage and how much focus there is on the shooting. So I don't have any evidence to support this, but this is just a thought that we have discussed as colleagues, is because it's notoriety, because it's often this own narcissism that motivates these people, besides their, you know, their psychological issues that they have. So the question is, does this intense media coverage, does it not increase the risk for future violence? Interesting question. We don't have the answer.
Anything else I'm missing?
Yeah, that, I mean, we talked about the gun, the accessibility of guns. There are guns in Europe. We know, for instance, for Switzerland and Austria, that there are lots of people with guns. But we don't see in those countries an increased use of that.
Are they military-style weapons, or are they mostly handheld weapons?
Yeah, military, because these soldiers, they can keep their guns after their military service. But also grandfather's gun that they used to shoot the deer, you know, is still in the house. So we know for Switzerland, they have a huge amount of weapons. But it's just not our culture. And I think that's another cultural issue that interests me and fascinates me, actually. If you compare that to the United States, I get the impression that in America, it's more of a male thing. It's something that makes this masculinity. It's the weapon is part of a certain culture. We don't have that. For us, it's just a tool. It's a tool that police uses. It's a tool that military use and that hunters use because they want to do their job. We don't have that culture of. I mean, it's just my thought. I'm not saying I'm a cultural expert. Just my ideas about how you view you in the United States, how you view weapons and use of weapons.
So, what about other forms of mass violence? Vehicle rammings can be common, particularly in the West. Alexander Roddy, author of Into the Crowd, The Evolution of Vehicular Attacks and Prevention Efforts, claims in mass casualty attacks in the West between January of 2012 and December of 2022, vehicular rammings were the second most common method of mass casualty attacks, only after mass shootings. Between 2014 and 2025, there were 18 documented terror-related rammings across the U.S., Canada, France, Sweden, the UK and Germany. In 2016, terror leader Abu Muhammad al-Adnani put a directive out to use vehicles to commit acts of terror, and there was an international surge. Deaths peaked in 2016 due to attacks in France and Germany. 98 people were killed, 48 the following year. But the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point says a bigger factor than a call by terrorists may have been the demonstration effect, or commonly referred to as the contagion effect, in which high casualties and significant media coverage influence other attacks.
It was noticeable following two of the deadliest attacks in Nice, France. 86 people were killed, 458 hurt in the span of 4 minutes and 17 seconds. And in Berlin, Germany, when 12 people were killed and 56 people were hurt. Within a year, there were 7 vehicle rammings in the U.S. and Europe, London, New York, Stockholm, Barcelona, Paris, and others. In the U.S. since 2012, there have been 56 deaths from intentional terrorist rammings. That includes Ohio State University in 2015.
An individual drove on to a sidewalk, striking several individuals, and then exited the vehicle with a knife and cut and or stabbed other individuals before being encountered by one of our campus police officers.
Charlottesville in 2017.
A circle of flowers and lit candles mark a spot just about a half a block from where a 32-year-old woman was fatally struck by a car that plowed into a crowd of protesters.
And New Orleans last year.
It was a huge impact. It almost sounded like gunshots. And then the screaming.
In fact, there was another uptick internationally in deaths at the end of 2024 and beginning of 2025, 29 globally. Fewer attacks, but more deaths. It's hard to pinpoint exactly how culture plays a role in choices to execute mass violence. Statistics show some trends have come and gone, including mass suicides, serial killings, European bombings, and hijackings. But there does appear to be something to the demonstration or contagion effect. History shows international crime trends can be stopped mid-stride through the right intervention. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, there was a surge in airline hijackings. In 1968, there were 28. In 1969, that number jumped to 84. 77 in 1970, 56 in 1971, 58 in 1972. Of the 303 recorded plane jackings, 123 of them were in the United States. What changed? In 1973, the U.S. introduced passenger screening of 100% of all passengers. Over the next 5 years, there were just 36 hijackings. In the 80s and 90s, there were about 20 to 30 hijackings worldwide annually. And between 2010 and 2019, there were only 15 worldwide. Of course, 9/11 contributed to even greater attention in airline security. International mass shootings may not get the same kind of press coverage in the U.S. as domestic shootings, but they can be some of the deadliest.
Australian authorities say 15 people were killed in a terrorist attack, the youngest victim, a 10-year-old girl. A rabbi who organized the event and a Holocaust survivor were also among the victims. Australian police say the two gunmen were father and son. The 50-year-old was killed by police, and the 24-year-old son is in custody in critical condition.
An act of anti-Semitism. An act of terrorism on our shores in an iconic Australian location, Bondi Beach. This was an attack deliberately targeted at the Jewish community on the first day of Hanukkah.
The anti-Semitic attack in Sydney, Australia, December 15, 2025, grabbed headlines around the world. One of the attackers was killed. The other, a 24-year-old, now faces 59 charges, including 15 counts of murder and a count of committing a terrorist attack. There is no death penalty in Australia. The maximum possible sentence is life in prison. On February 4, 2025, a 35-year-old man, a former student of Rebro School, used several weapons to shoot up the Swedish adult education campus. 10 people were killed. Another 6 were hurt before the shooter turned the gun on himself. Police say the man had previously had suicidal tendencies. Among the 5 deadliest mass shootings of all time around the world, on July 22, 2011, a Norwegian neo-Nazi terrorist killed 8 people by detonating a van bomb, then carried out a mass shooting, killing 69 people at a summer youth camp. 33 of those victims were children. He was sentenced to Norway's maximum prison sentence for a civilian,
21 years behind bars, but he could be eligible for more time once that term ends. A drunk South Korean policeman stormed a farm community, killing 62 people in four different neighborhoods. He wounded dozens of others on April 26, 1982. It's dubbed the Wubong Khan Rampage. When police confronted him, the gunman blew himself up, along with a handful of hostages he had taken. The shooting in Las Vegas on the Strip in 2017 is the third deadliest. 60 people killed. The gunman took his own life. On March 15, 2019, an Australian man committed multiple shootings at a mosque and Islamic center. 51 people were killed, 89 hurt. The gunman, an anti-immigrant white nationalist, live-streamed the attack on social media. That gunman was the first person ever in New Zealand sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The fifth deadliest was the shooting at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando in 2016, 49 people dead. The gunman was fatally shot by officers during a three-hour standoff. That shooting was deemed a terrorist attack. Of those five, two were in the U.S. All but one happened in the 2010s. If you expand the list out further, the sixth was the Port Arthur massacre in Australia, 35 people killed in April of 1996. 2007, Virginia Tech, 32 dead. In 2020, the Korat shooting in Thailand left 31 dead. Then it's Sandy Hook, Sutherland Springs, the Luby's massacre in Killeen, Texas, El Paso, the San Ysidro McDonald's in San Diego, Robb Elementary, and Lewistown, Maine.
I am Jason Silva. I'm a professor at William Patterson University. I run the Global Mass Shooting Database. It's the largest mass shooting database in the world. And a lot of my research focuses on mass shootings in other quote-unquote developed countries, right? So the 35 countries that are most similar to the United States, thinking about countries that are in the European Union, and then countries like talking about Australia, New Zealand, things of that nature. And so what I've found is that the United States has more mass shootings than any other country in these developed countries. It is the largest, so it makes sense to some degree that it would have more. That said, it accounts for about 73% of the mass shootings versus only accounting for about 33% of the population of these cumulative countries. So it definitely makes up the largest percentage. And we also need to think about how about half of these countries have never had a mass shooting. And the handful that have only had about one or two. So these shootings are really only occurring in a handful of countries. Outside of the United States, we've seen several incidents in places like France, as well as Germany. Those are two other countries similar to the United States that have had a handful of incidents.
Let's kind of step back for a second. How do you define mass shooting?
So in terms of looking at the global stuff, I define it the most traditional way, which is four people killed in a public location where the majority of them are either shot at random or for their symbolic value. So that's like the baseline kind of definition. And the reason I do this for the global material is that it's going to be increasingly more difficult to obtain information about incidents that have less casualties or occur in the home or involve, like, for instance, felony attacks. And so to ensure that we are making accurate comparisons, we focus on the public mass shootings involving four or more people killed. That said, in the United States, I do a ton of research in the U.S. I'm very interested in what we refer to as like attempted, failed, foiled mass shootings, which is incidents that involve less than four fatalities, because we want to see how did these incidents fail. Right. In other words, what can we learn from the shootings that individuals are attempting to kill four or more people, but ultimately don't succeed? And so this is critical for understanding and preventing these attacks. But just in terms of global comparisons, becomes increasingly difficult to analyze that kind of material. In addition, we see in the U.S. that when it comes to the four or more people killed, 50% are actually family mass shootings. In other words, in most cases, it's a husband who kills his wife and children. And this is a serious problem in the United States. It's kind of like not really considered or looked at that often. But again, this is hard to compare globally.
And it's interesting to point out that we're coming off of what happened at Brown University, and technically there were only two people dead there, exactly, as far as we know at this point. So that would not qualify under that standard, even though I think most of us would think that, you know, someone walking into a classroom and opening fire would be a mass shooting. So it's kind of strange in those regards. But I've noticed as part of your recent research, it seems as though the American tendency is starting to leak over to other countries. Are you noticing an increase in these kind of shootings in other countries of late?
So, as I was saying, only about half the countries have had mass shootings. But we are seeing, unfortunately, an increase in other countries, these other developed countries. In the U.S., over the last 10 years, it's been relatively consistent, right? We haven't seen a tremendous increase. We also, unfortunately, haven't seen a decrease. However, overseas, we are seeing an increase in these shootings. So it's nearly doubled in the last 13 years when we're thinking about the turn of the century. And it is occurring in a handful more countries. We're seeing, for instance, the first shootings in countries that previously hadn't had one before at the turn of the century. And so there is this concern about the globalization of American mass shootings.
Is the motivation different in these shootings? Are we seeing a difference in the motives between the shootings that we see here in the United States versus what we might see in Germany, France?
So very similar motives, in that outside the United States, most of the shootings are involving either fame-seeking offenders or ideological offenders. And this is concerning for several reasons. First of all, some offenders who are fame-seeking are also ideological. And when I say fame-seeking, I mean they want personal notoriety. And ideological, I'm talking about like the Australia shooter, things like jihadist-inspired extremists, far right, and this is less common overseas, but in the U.S. sometimes far left terrorists. We have similar problems in the United States as we do in other countries with these two types of offenders. This is the biggest problem overseas because these are also oftentimes the deadliest offenders. And so if we look at the deadliest attacks, those involving like 10 or more people killed, overwhelmingly they are either fame-seeking or ideological. We have this same issue with the deadliest attacks in the U.S. being fame-seeking and ideological. What we have that other countries don't have as much is we have a lot more workplace violence.
Okay. So workplace, I mean, what do you factor in mental health? I know we've, veterans, other people that might go into these public spaces.
I mean, we do see about like 50% of shooters in the U.S. have some sort of mental health issues at some point in their lives. So this is definitely a contributing factor. The issue becomes, addressing macro level mental health issues in the United States as well as in other countries, incredibly difficult. So when it comes to prevention, I focus less on mental health as I do other forms of like more immediate response prevention efforts.
Is there a correlation between the amount of guns inside of a country and the number of these mass shootings? Does that matter?
I mean, studies show time and time again, outside of mass shootings, more guns equal more gun deaths, right? If you have more guns prevalent in society, there's going to be more homicides, more suicides, and more accidental shootings with firearms. So this is going to be inherent. Guns is definitely a contributing factor, and this is something that several studies have shown, not just within mass shootings, but across all types of firearm violence. And so, for instance, we see in countries like China and Japan, these are also very large countries like the United States, but they have virtually no mass shootings, and this is because they have extremely stringent gun laws.
I got to believe we're not the only country that has guns being legal or the right to bear arms. What have you kind of noticed as far as that? Some of these South American countries, I know they're not part of your study, but some of these other countries, do they have as much gun ownership per capita as we do?
So, I mean, we see with Brazil, they have a big school shooting problem. And so, I mean, this is a little bit different than mass shootings, but they have they're similar, and they also have these sort of fame seekers like the United States. They are idolizing American mass shooters, and they're engaging in school shootings similar to what we see in the United States. And this is, to some degree, their ability to access weapons.
Are these countries, because of this, taking more precautions to prevent these kind of incidents?
So this is hard to measure, right? Because I'm not familiar with every single country's individual policing efforts. The thing that we're seeing is that with a lot of these countries, they've only had one, maybe two mass shooting. So it becomes this kind of balance. How much liberty are you willing to give up to ensure your security? Are you willing to change your whole country because of this single incident? Right. And so we look at somewhere like Norway and New Zealand. They had two of the deadliest mass shootings, but they were also the only incidents. Both of those happened to involve, quote unquote, assault rifles. And for those of you listening, don't come after me for using the word assault rifle. You know what I'm trying to say here. But they did then end up implementing bans on assault rifles, which, you know, so far has not resulted in another mass shooting. But going back to policing efforts, I mean, a fast response is ultimately the number one thing we're going to want. And we see within these countries that haven't really had incidents before, they are delayed in their responses. And this has ultimately led to more people getting killed. And so it would benefit them to implement strategies for more rapid police response. At the same time, how much time, effort, and money are they going to dedicate to this if it was this isolated incident? We see somewhere like France. France has had several instances, and they have been much quicker with their responses. And we've actually seen an increase at the turn of the century of people, of police in France killing the offenders, where previously offenders were not very likely to be killed in many of these developed countries.
One of the theories I had been kind of tinkering around with is there a cultural aspect to the United States that might make it a little different, as far as, let's say that there is evil, there's evil in the world and it's lurking among us. How does it get out? And, you know, we've seen in the Middle East before suicide bombings. We've seen hostage situations. We've seen knife events in Europe. We've seen car rammings at Chris Kindle markets in Germany. I mean, is there a cultural aspect to this? I mean, is it possible that mass casualty events are going to get out, whether they're shooting or not, whether, you know, if someone doesn't have access to a gun, well, then I'm going to use a car, or I'm going to try to detonate myself inside of a church. Have you noticed that at all? Has your research looked into that?
For sure. I mean, there's always going to be people who want to engage in violence, right? But if we look at a country like China, they have zero mass shoot or almost zero mass shootings. And this is because they have very strict gun laws. So what do they have instead? They have a very high rate of mass stabbings. So there is a concern, right? We take away guns, people are going to turn to alternative means. However, if you look at China, they also have very low fatality rates during these incidents, because you are going to be much more likely to kill more people with a firearm. So if you're in a country with a firearm, offenders know this is the best strategy to kill the most people. And if they're fame-seeking ideological, they want to kill the most people to get the most attention. And so they're going to turn to a firearm. If they can't, they turn to alternative means. This ultimately is going to lead to less people being killed, at the very least.
People here in America, we don't walk into synagogues and blow them up. You know what I mean? Like, it would be a shooting. It would not be that. We've seen a few more vehicle rammings. Some of those have been mental health related. But I just wonder if there's like just a different culturally, I want to take out people, but, you know, this is how we do it here in this part of the world.
Down to building a bomb is hard, right? You have to be pretty smart. And we're not seeing many of these individuals. They're not necessarily the smartest. Okay. And so if you can't build a bomb, or if you're worried that it's not going to be successful, if you have access to a gun, you recognize that this is a much more efficient means and a lot easier to do. And this is why we're seeing, even in the United States, most of the deadly terrorist attacks in the United States, they're now involving firearms. They're not involving bombs. They're not involving, you know, 9/11 was really an outlier. This was planned over many years, involved many people, extremely rare for this to occur. If you're a lone wolf individual, then you're going to be much more successful if you attempt to use a firearm than if you attempt to use a bomb.
But there have been instances where there have been, you know, jihadis who have called for vehicle rammings. And we actually saw, I think, that step up in Europe. We saw what happened in New Orleans last year as well, that seemed to be terror driven. So vehicle rammings are still, it seems like, a go-to in some of these situations.
Yes, definitely. And but still relatively rare compared to other means.
You've done some research on how we in the media frame these events. What have you learned from that?
as I was talking about earlier, many of these individuals, they're fame seeking, they're ideological, right? They either want personal attention or they want to promote their ideological views. And so both of those things require attention. And so the media plays a huge role here, right? And the more media attention that we give these individuals, the more quote unquote successful that they are. And so I am, along with many mass shooting scholars, a big proponent of the No Notoriety campaign, the idea of not focusing on the offenders, not putting their name on the front page or their picture on the front page. We don't want to turn these individuals into celebrities, right? Oftentimes, use the example, after the Boston Marathon bombing, there was that famous Rolling Stone magazine that came out, and it had the Boston Marathon bomber on the cover all by himself looking sexy, almost like a celebrity. And this is going to drive other offenders who are interested in gaining this type of notoriety to do something similar. And so instead of focusing on the offenders, we should be focusing on the victims. So for instance, there was this Washington Post article that came out a few years ago after the school shooting in Uvalde, and they showed all of the images of the devastation. They showed all of the blood in the classrooms. And so if you're someone who's interested in doing this, instead of seeing this role model getting idealized, you say to yourself, oh, look at this actual devastation. And we see that many times there are mass shooters who start their attack and ultimately commit suicide before finishing it because they realize that this fantasy doesn't match the reality. And so the idea is that if we focus on the victims, we show the devastation, hopefully they'll recognize the fantasy doesn't match the reality before they ultimately go out and engage in their attacks.
As a member of the media, though, I mean, it's tough to put that back. I mean, we're watching, you know, who is this gunman, at Brown University? We don't know a name. And once we do, we're going to go out and report. We're not going to not report it because people are looking for it. How do you put that back in the bottle? You know what I mean?
It's a rare instance, too, though, because he was able to escape, which almost never occurs. So the media does need to put his picture out there in order for us to be able to try and figure out who he is. So this is a little bit unique.
We could ignore them and pretend that they don't exist after the shooting takes place. But is there value in finding out why this person was radicalized, why they did what they did, and really trying to drive into that? Because there are going to be a lot of people who engaged with this shooter beforehand and said, oh, if I would have known or I could have seen the signs, maybe we would have done something.
We want to be able to recognize the warning signs, right? And it seems so far that Australia coverage is doing a pretty good job. I mean, they're showing the heroic actions of many of the people who ultimately died. This is good coverage, whereas we're not seeing, the shooter's faces plastered all over the front page, while we are still contextualizing their backgrounds in order to understand how this happened and maybe the warning signs that we should be aware of.
Do you think we're getting better at it in the media than we were maybe during Columbine?
I am definitely hopeful, especially since Columbine. During Columbine, we were very much focused on the shooters, and the immediate aftermath, we were very focused on the shooters. I'm hopeful seeing a shift.
And at least from my perspective, someone who's covered a lot of these, we kind of fall into the lull, like this is how we're supposed to cover it. First we go here, then we do this, then we talk to this person. It's a cycle. You do what you know, and as a result, that's kind of the reporting looks the same every single time, right?
It's become a routine experience, not just for the media, but for all of American culture, right? And the shooters recognize this and they say, how am I going to get more attention than the last guy? I need to kill more people. And this is the main concern. And so we're seeing they're trying to get, with school shooters, quote unquote, the new high score, killing more people than the last to finally get more attention, because we know this is the number one factor driving media coverage.
Anything we're missing? Anything else that you want to bring up?
Well, you brought up warning signs. And so I just want to say I do a lot of research. I have a National Institute of Justice grant right now that I'm working on that we focus on leakage. And so we see that a large majority of these offenders tell someone or give hints that they're going to do this beforehand. And so similar to what we learned in the aftermath of 9/11, the see something, say something campaign, this is hyper prevalent to addressing the mass shooting problem. And so I do a lot of work on foiled mass shootings, and we see that with all these foiled instances, they leaked information that they were going to engage in these attacks. And ultimately, someone stepped in and said, hey, this person's kind of suspicious, and we were able to stop it beforehand. And we're seeing a lot of foiled mass shootings in the U.S., and so I'm hoping that this style of approach can also be used overseas.
I want to point out there have been deadlier attacks worldwide that may not fall wholly under the umbrella of mass shootings. 175 people were killed in the Mumbai terror attacks in 2008. In 2014, the Peshawar school massacre killed 149 people. In Garissa, Kenya, in 2015, a university attack left 148 dead. And the attacks in Paris in November of 2015 left 130 dead. Bombs, explosive vests, and fires were also used in some of these deadly attacks.